with this high-level preliminaries, now let me introduce the first speaker, Mike. Maybe for those of you who don't know him, let me say some words. I think first of all we should be thankful to him because he's the PhilSoft's webmaster, so he's managing the website. And this brings him already very close to computer science, and in fact he has earned a PhD in artificial intelligence from Bristol University after I think he studied physics and mathematics and statistics. And he was pursuing a career in systems programming, supporting scientists like biologists, geneticists, bioinformaticians. And last but not least, he's an avid reader of science fiction. So I think all this, I think who could be more qualified, you know, for the topic, that's the first topic, can computers really think? So Mike, please.
Thank you, Christian, for the introduction. I already feel like quarreling slightly with 2 points there. I'm sure we'll come to that. And to a certain extent, I'm glad that he already softened you to the fact that computers are somehow involved. I know that when you talk to philosophers about minds and thinking, mentioning computers tends to be a little bit controversial, particularly when you sort of kick off a whole session on thought with, can computers think? The difficulty with the question I pose is really that we need to understand the terms the question uses in order to be even to start considering what it means, let alone answering it. What do we mean by computer? Do we mean a kind of glorified abacus? Well, those obviously can't think, that's obvious. Do we mean modern day digital computers? I don't think anybody claims that those can think. Whether such machines could potentially think is a more contentious question. More generally, whether an artifact could think in some way, well, general information processing artifact. That begs the question, of course, in the sense that that assumes that thinking is just to do with information processing. And whether or not that is the case is one of the core issues of the whole subject, surely. Similarly, think. What do we mean by think? Christian already kind of mentioned this, that on the one hand, some people reckon that thinking is just strictly the familiar inner monologue, verbal monologue, the stream of consciousness. On the other hand, there are voices around which are saying very firmly that the stream of consciousness is a very recent invention. Purely Western culture invented it about 400 or 500 years ago. Of course, we can also say that thinking is more generally any kind of identifiable mental process, be it conscious or not. That seems to be pushing things a little bit too far, but there is no real consensus of what we mean by thinking. In a way, that's what this gathering is all about, to consider the various ways. And finally, the disqualification of can they really think. There is a view amongst philosophers that even if computers could simulate thought, simulation is not the same as the real thing. Surely, simulated water isn't wet. Therefore, computers may simulate thought, but they can't think. Well, that doesn't strike me as a very good argument. I won't go there. That way lie philosophical zombies, and I can do no better than to refer you to Dennett's brilliant demolition. You got a quote from him on the reverse of the handout, which sums up certainly his view and certainly my view of the subject. So we'll leave zombies aside. What I would like to do is to rephrase the question of the title in terms of the core assumptions of moderate artificial intelligence. Please note the word moderate. There are immoderate people around, and I have no intention of quarreling with them. I've had my fill of that. That assumption says that it is possible for an information processing artifact to exhibit sentient behavior. Note that I am avoiding the use of intelligent behavior, because intelligence is acquired in the meantime so much baggage that it's best avoided. The very term artificial intelligence is a very unfortunate one. Artificial sentience would be a much better term. Trouble is, we don't really know enough to be able to answer the question whether or not the assumption, the central assumption of artificial intelligence is correct or not. Consequently, practically any argument on the subject devolves one way or another to asserting that a particular proposition either is or is not conceivable. In other words, all those arguments really appeal to our intuitions rather than to our reason, and then it's coined a very useful phrase to my mind, intuition pump. Intuition pump is not quite an argument, but it's a little story, or it is an argument which doesn't quite address the core subject, but which primes your intuition towards answering the main question one way or the other. And I'm sure you've met a number of these intuition pumps. Sorry, I expected to see here rather something else, don't worry. Such as Chinese Room, Chinese Nation, Swamp Man, Mary the Blind Scientist, etc., etc. I am biased, having spent 30 years as a systems programmer, and therefore, naturally enough, I think that programming and computers in general provide very useful analogies which can be used as intuition pumps when thinking about this subject. I haven't got my notes which tell me in advance what the next slide says. I had in mind originally three distinct possibilities what I might discuss today. One was to do with the assertion, which I believe was heard in this very, on these premises from Professor Tallis earlier in this year, saying, "I am not my brain." Well, you know, it's not quite as simple as that. Similarly, John Searle is known to argue that computers of classicals can't think because, you cannot just assume that brain is just a computer, because computers are syntactic engines. Minds are about semantics, about meanings, and you cannot get semantics out of syntax. Again, once you look at the philosophy of information technology, and one of the links I provided on the website for this shows that that distinction is a bit iffy in the context of computers, which is quite surprising and interesting. But in the end, I settled on the third example of intuition pump derived from computers, which is much closer to the topic of today's gathering, that is, to the nature of thought. So let's consider thoughts and brains. As I said already, we really don't know enough to answer the main question, but we can say a few things. And the main thing we can say is that thoughts and brains are somehow linked. We don't really know, at least we can argue about how it happens, whether or not thoughts occur in the brain, or just brains channel thoughts or whatever, but never mind about that. We can agree that thoughts and brains are somehow linked. Now, Christian already mentioned that there is a slight distinction in philosophy of mind between thought as states and thought as processes. For me, that doesn't really make sense, because minds are in permanent flux, so are brains. You can't really say the brain is a particular state, the mind is a particular state. Mind in a static state is a dead mind. The brain in a particular state is a dead brain. Therefore, I tend to use events, processes, states in this context as being more or less interchangeable. Please forgive me for that if it's not the usage you are used to. The question arises, when we consider thoughts and brains, whether mental events and physical events relate, and if so, how do they relate? There have been a number of different answers historically to this question, and I'll run through the main ones. Please note, I'm not trying to do them justice. I'm not trying to explain what they actually mean. This is just to remind you of something which you probably know already anyway, just putting things into context. Firstly, there is dualism. I'm sure you are all aware of dualism as advocated by Descartes in particular, which simply says that there is no connection between mind events and brain events. The two are ontologically separate. Dualism, of course, has a notorious problem of explaining exactly how minds do connect to bodies, to brains, to whatever, to the physical embodiment of a human being. And that's one reason why dualism really is no longer in favor. Then there is epiphenomenalism. I do wish they selected a better word for that. It's sort of difficult to pronounce. I always stumble on that one. Epiphenomenalism, for some reason, is often bracketed with dualism. I don't quite understand that. Maybe Marianne can explain why that seems to be the case. It says that mental events are completely irrelevant. They are just irrelevant side effects of the functioning of the brain. They are an epiphenomenon. My difficulty with that is that I can't think of any real life other example of what might be called epiphenomenon. The classic example is, oh, well, you know, when you have an engine produces noise, and that noise does no real work. It's just that irrelevant side effect of the engine's working. Well, that actually is false. It's a bad intuition pump, because that noise does do work. It's just not the work you want to be done. It does do the work of vibrating your eardrums and therefore making you hear it, because otherwise you wouldn't hear the damn thing. So it's not a good intuition pump. There was something else to say, I can't remember what it was. Too bad. Then in the mid-20th century, there was briefly in ascendance the identity theory, which said that ontologically there was a complete identity between brain states and mind states. It was one-to-one correspondence. That didn't last very long. It got shot down by Kripke in pretty short order, and with hindsight, it was far too simplistic to account for the connection between minds and brains. More recent, and very much still with us, is functionalism, which occurs in a number of different flavors. Functionalism asserts that mental events are multiply realizable as brain events, i.e. that there is a one-to-many correspondence between mind states, mind events, and brain events. I was looking through Marianne's slides from her 2011 Romps through Philosophy of Mind, and I was interested to see that she said that functionalism may be acceptable provided one is referred to which qualia, the famous qualia of the philosophers. Personally, I'm very happy to teach them, so I have no problem with that. We might have mind not get back to that. Then there is anomalous monism, and that has the reputation of being difficult, being counterintuitive. So guess which one I like best. No prizes there. Anomalous monism was originated by Davidson, I believe. I don't think there are any forerunners. I keep calling Davidson Donaldson, by the way. He's Donald Davidson. So if I slip from being able to read on screen, forgive me. It's not Donaldson, it's Davidson. I can't remember what my next slide is. Okay, no, it isn't. It was the previous slide. Right. Okay. I recently discovered, to my great surprise, that anomalous monism was strongly supported by Davidson's teacher, Quine, and that Quine explicitly himself placed it in a context in which I wish to place it later. You do have also on the handouts on the reverse a quote from a letter from Quine published by Hilary Putnam on his blog quite recently, where Quine quite explicitly states his full support for anomalous monism and places it in the context of his thesis of my memory is failing me, of the difficulty of translation, indeterminacy of translation, thank you. Right, so what is anomalous monism? Again, I can't pretend to be an expert, not with Marianne sitting there, no way. So I'll run you through the basics of it, that's the best I can do. First of all, anomalous monism says that at least some mental events interact causally with physical events, i.e. that the interaction is not all the way from physical to mental, that there is actually some real interaction from mental to physical. Secondly, it says that events related as cause and effect fall under strict laws, and it adds what those strict laws are. By the way, if you are interested where those particular phrases come from, they are not from Davidson himself, they are from Stanford's entry on the subject, which I found to be much clearer in many respects. These first two assertions probably don't strike any of you as too outrageous. It's the third one which usually raises the eyebrows. There are no strict laws, as opposed to mere generalizations, relating mental and physical events. that usually strikes people as surprising, because after all, number one says there is causal interaction. Number two says if there is causal interaction, there is laws. Number three says there are no laws. Surely, there must be something wrong. Monism must be self-contradictory. We'll set this aside for a moment. There are further objections to this line of thought. Specifically, it is thought that anomalous monism collapses into epiphenomenalism. Why is that? Well, according to anomalous monism, the physical states, physical events, are fully causative, and therefore you don't really need anything, you don't need mental on top of physical in order to account for the behavior of human beings. Mental somehow looks surplus to requirements. And even if you somehow avoid that particular charge, there is a third difficulty, and that is that if you allow for the fact my mind is going blank again, that there is no epiphenomenalism, you seem to run into the same difficulty that dualism has. Okay, if there are no strict laws, then how come if I wish to touch my nose, I touch my nose quite reliably? You know, how does that happen in such a case? Anomalous monism is, however, very attractive. Just by the fact that it's monism, if nothing else, I'm a scientist, so yes, I would find it attractive. With Marianne's permission, I'll pinch some phrasing from her slides from that Romsdorff Philosophy of Mind from 2011. That, by the way, is available on the website, and so I can heartily recommend it to all of you. It's good, it really is good. I shouldn't be there, but yeah, I'll give you that. But I was afraid I would argue too much. Firstly, anomalous monism is physicalist, because it insists that every causally efficacious mental token, I'll talk about tokens in a moment, has a physical description. So it is a purely, one could say, scientific theory of mind. It is also attractive because it is non-reductive. It does not imply that you can reduce the mind entirely to the physical events. No, mind has an existence of its own under the anomalous monism picture. It is non-reductive insofar as each token of the mental state type might have a different physical description. Again, I'll come to the meaning of these words in a moment. And the third attractive point is that effectively, anomalous monism permits us to talk about the space of reasons. I'll read it for you, Marianne. The state is governed by a physical law, whilst in virtue of mental description, the state can underwrite reasoned explanations of behavior. I think those three statements describe exactly what I want to have from a theory of mind. Right now, what does it all mean? Laws, general laws as we know them, natural laws, they're about type-type interactions. What do I mean by that? You probably know what types and tokens are. Type is a general type of something. For example, when I say a swan, I mean any swan in the world will do. You know, it's collection of all possible swans is a type of swans. A token is a particular swan. This swan here is a token of a swan. The type itself, well, nominalists would say it consists of all the tokens of that type. But again, we'll now go into the distinction between nominalism, etc., conceptualism, and realism. That's essentially the distinction. The type is a generic thing, token is instantiation or exemplar of the generic thing. Sorry, I'm jumping again. If you consider, for example, Newton's gravitational law, that talks very much about types. It says that a body and another body will attract each other in such and such proportion, with such and such force. Because it applies to type of physical body, it also applies to every token, every specific instantiation of those bodies. So the law is about type, but its application is about tokens of that type. The problem is, it's not a problem, but the fact is the Deism is proposing that only token identity exists between the brain and the mind. And because it's only token identity, not a type identity, therefore you cannot have a general law to connect mind with the brain. As I said already, there is a connection with Quine's radical indeterminacy of translation, and we can indeed illustrate this from human languages. For example, if we do have a German here, it so happens, I'm sure you will agree that this is a stool. I would say it's a chair or jibla, or if I were in Russian, stool. It does not mean that if they agree about this token chair, but it does not mean that the extension of the German stool is the same as the extension of English word chair. Those are different. So they have a token identity here, kind of, but the types do not match. Not quite. And it is actually worse with other languages, with Russian in particular, but I can't call Russian, not few people don't know Russian here. And Quine, in that quote I gave you on the reverse of the handout, seems to support this, because he says that his only difference with Davidson on the subject of anomalous monism is indeed in his greater interest in languages, in linguistics, in formulations of scientific theories as language, as opposed to Davidson, who is more interested in minds. But the context appears to be very much in the determinacy of translation. Right, now, I promised to say something about computers, introduce computer analogies, so far I only talked about various theories of mind. How does anomalous monism connect with computers? Well, one of the very powerful ways of investigating the structure of an argument is to translate that argument to another concept, to another context, and to see whether its logic still holds. So what I propose to do is to follow Einstein's famous advice to keep things as simple as possible, but not simpler, and to translate anomalous monism into computing terms in a very, very, very primitive way. Simply brain, hardware, mind, software. Please note, I am not asserting that there is such real equivalence. I am not saying that brains are equivalent to hardware and minds to software. I am simply translating the argument to another context in order to investigate the validity of the structure of the argument. Okay. Right, so let's translate. The first statement now of anomalous monism now reads, at least some software events interact causally with hardware events. I'm sure that a lot of you will have experienced, for example, the famous blue screen of death. Mm-hmm. When a computer crash, a software crash, causes a hardware change, namely your screen has just gone blue. So, you know, there's no doubt that that particular software and the crash of the software caused the physical change. So, quite obviously, this is the case. Secondly, events related as cause and effect fall under strict laws. Well, yes, I don't think anybody would dispute that computers are strictly about strict laws and strictly about causality. Nothing funny, nothing more hanky-panky is going on underneath. Computers are computers. And thirdly, there are no strict laws relating software and hardware events. I'm sure that will come as a surprise to most of you. But I also suspect, in fact, I seem to remember there are one or two members here who probably know enough to know that I'm not talking rubbish. So, please note, I'm not talking rubbish, and I'll try to explain why. The difficulty I have here is that I cannot really introduce you to the complete theory of computation where it becomes quite obvious, but I'll do my best. In order to talk about anomalous monism in computer sense, I need to introduce you to the notion of virtual patterns. That is a slightly unusual term. The usual term in computeries is logical patterns. The trouble is, as Eileen pointed out to me, and I'm very grateful for that, logical patterns may be misunderstood to mean that those patterns must somehow have logic embedded in them. That is not what the term means. And therefore, in order to avoid any confusion, I'm going to try to use virtual patterns instead, even though it's less usual term. Here's an example of a virtual pattern. I'll leave you a few seconds to read through this unfortunate sequence of events. I don't know whether any of you spotted what's going on here yet. I thought you might. But just in case you haven't. Okay, it's an acrostic. It's a slightly unusual acrostic because it takes the first three letters of each line, not just the first letter of each line. It is also an example of a virtual pattern. A virtual pattern is a pattern which only exists when you know how to see it. If you don't know how to see it, it simply is not there. There is a rule which tells you how to extract the virtual pattern from its background or from its own scramble state if there is no background. The rule in this case is trivially simple. It can be arbitrarily complex, or in fact it can be completely arbitrary. It can be just a list of positions on the page to pick up letters in order. So for example, I can guarantee that any reasonably long page of English text will contain the message "Bomb London." I hope I don't get arrested for this one. Okay. It's a virtual pattern. Unless I give you that list of numbers which says line so-and-so, position so-and-so, that pattern isn't there. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is, I should have switched onto this slide. That's what I'm going to say. Running programs, that is software threads, forgive me for using computerese without explaining it, but I really cannot explain too much, are dynamic virtual patterns in computer memory. Now, dynamic is fairly obvious because a program can exist just in static form. I'm talking about executing programs, but program is actually running, so it's dynamic as opposed to just static list of some sort. But they are virtual patterns. What do I mean? When you run a program, any program whatsoever, as far as that program is concerned, it has a contiguous, private, purely linear memory space. Several programs will be running simultaneously, and your PC will run a number of them simultaneously you don't even know about, so don't worry about the fact, but they are all there. Each of them has private, extended, linear, contiguous memory space. That memory space doesn't exist. It is actually consisting of chunks which are scattered all over the physical memory of the machine in a completely contingent order. And I mean completely contingent. Nobody can predict what order it is going to be because it depends entirely on what's gone on this computer before. What is more, that mapping from virtual memory to physical memory is highly dynamic. It is quite often normal for a process for running threads to clone itself for a variety of reasons, and again, let's not go into why. When this happens, initially, the two processes share their physical memory completely. They just have exactly the same physical memory, which maps exactly in the same manner on their logical memory. The moment one of them modifies that memory in any way, that particular piece of memory gets written somewhere else. And where else? We don't know. Wherever there is, happens to be empty space in physical memory, and yet at the same time, both programs, both threads, still see exactly the same what they saw before, namely their private space, completely contiguous, unviolated, etc., etc. So there really is no stable connection between physical memory and logical memory as seen, sorry, virtual memory as seen by any given process. Which is why we can't have a law-like, we can't see a law-like connection between states of software and states of hardware. There is an objection, of course, a fairly obvious one. I already said that in order to see a virtual pattern, you need an extra information to be able to see it. In this case, the extra information is provided by the operating system. So you can reasonably argue that if we take the operating system as a whole, then we still should be able to recover some law-like connection between the software and the hardware. It doesn't work. Firstly, such a law would consist largely of exceptions, would be a list of exceptions, effectively. But there is a much stronger reason as well, and that is computer security. For reasons of computer security, operating systems are constantly evolving in the direction of being themselves virtual patterns. It hasn't been done yet, but there are serious proposals that next generation of computer operating systems will randomize themselves on loading when the machine is starting up, completely at random into the memory, delete the information which delete the part which did the randomizing, and then run as a completely random virtual pattern. In other words, it becomes a self-describing virtual pattern. There is no external description of it. It is the pattern itself knows how to run within itself. And again, that loses you completely any law-like connection between software and hardware. So the operating system are evolving towards becoming self-describing dynamic virtual patterns. Right, so anomalous monism appears to work fine for computers. Therefore, it cannot be self-contradictory. As such a status, logically it hangs together. Software is not a phenomenon. I don't think anybody would try to assert that computers really are just twiddling bits and software is just a phenomenon of this twiddling bits. I mean, sorry, you'd be laughed out of course, seriously. Software events can reliably cause hardware events. Well, yes, I mean, if that weren't the case, the display of your screen would be completely unreliable, wouldn't it? Computers would be useless. Suppose we accept that anomalous monism does make sense in an IT context. Are there any implications that follow from that? I think there are. Firstly, as I already said, anomalous monism is a coherent position. Therefore, if you wish to deny that it applies to brains and minds, you need some additional arguments which are specific to the context of brains and minds. You cannot attack anomalous monism on its own. Secondly, a thought. Maybe thought science, I'd better read this bit because I like the way I wrote it and it was in my notes, but of course I don't have these notes. Returning to our theme of nature of thought, a proposal seems to me a fairly natural suggestion. That thoughts are dynamic virtual patterns on neural activity of brains, sustained by the self-describing grand dynamic virtual pattern of the mind. Perhaps our difficulties with the mind-body relationship lie in our looking for physical patterning of the mind, rather than allowing for self-describing virtual patterning. So, could computers really think? Well, that depends how you interpret the question. I frankly can't see any reason why they shouldn't. Thank you for your attention. I know I will run for that.
Okay.
Any questions?
It was very, very fascinating, so I'm very impressed by this idea. So we slightly overdraw the speaking time, so we have 7 minutes for our questions. If there are more questions, we have the round table after the four presentations, so you can keep the question and then ask it after afterwards. Okay, so Bob will manage the session. Right, well, Mike will take questions for the next 7 minutes.
Any questions,
Chris? Come on, I'm going to remember some names, not others, so I apologize. Chris?
Does thinking, in your view, involve having subjective experience? If it does, how could you ever know whether it's good or not?
I'm in one with Dennett on this one, in that I do believe that what we are really talking about is this question whether intentionality is intrinsic or ascribed. I do not believe there is such a thing as intrinsic intentionality. And interestingly enough, thank you for reminding me of this, I understand that Davidson himself originally was motivated for his anomalous monism proposal by exactly this consideration. How do we know that somebody's, that there's intentionality present in behavior of some system, object, animal, whatever?
The answer to that appears to be that we cannot know. That the only intentionality I can be sure of is my own, and that's it. So the question doesn't really trouble me as a result. If I may, Marianne is probably itching to ask one question, which I skipped because of the pressure of time. You did raise it in your 2011 presentation, and that was the question of the nature of causation. You said there that anomalous monism seems to force us to adopt a rather unusual view of causation, because it assumed that the relator of causation are events rather than properties. Okay.
Token events.
I think I can answer that. And that is, this is mixing two separate levels. I think that we should say that within the virtual, each of the programs I was describing is effectively running on its own virtual machine. There is complete connectivity of causal connectivity between properties of software and properties of the virtual machine. The startup description, no problem with Sarah Kripke's objections, and it doesn't apply, there is no duality. You have similar separation of physical one. What happens is that artificially or contingently, depending on whether or not the effect is intended, like for example when I wish to display something on the screen and it does happen, or not intended, like in blue screen or this, there is a mapping from that, from the state of the virtual machine to the physical machine, which is not contingent. So you have causation within virtual world, causation within physical world, and the connection between the two is one-to-one type mapping, very restricted type of mapping, which is either contingent or not, as the case may be. You see what I mean? Anybody else? Anything else? Come on, Peter.
Struck by an analogy with human development, that the collision seems to be, that you're describing, seems to be very much like the human animal. I mean, taking the embryo as a kind of model of that, the way in which the fairly simple programming develops in widely different ways according to environmental accidents or circumstances, chemical changes and so on. And of course, once the child is born, then the environmental accidents are even more varied. But nothing is happening, it seems to me, something different from what happens to the computer at the course of the system.
You're absolutely right, and that was one of the points I was making in my PhD thesis, that the objections to computers being able to think on the grounds that they are fully predictable machines is completely misguided, because what is not predictable is their environment. And because they're interacting with the environment, just like we do, therefore the overall this system environment machine is not predictable. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. There was something else that crossed my mind as you were talking. And I can't remember what it was. So that's me. Anybody else?
Eileen.
Okay.
Right. We've got Chris at the back.
You said right at the start, and something that I don't think anyone would disagree with, that computers cannot, currently anyway, simulate human thought in general.
Yeah.
However, turning it around the other way, a human will appear rather slowly can simulate completely accurately what a computer does.
Sure.
For example, when I'm doing my doing some calculations in my bank account. So when I'm doing that, do you think I'm doing exactly what the computer does, that we are actually carrying out the same process?
No, I don't. Or rather, I do and I don't. Computers as we know them were constructed in the wrong way, were invented, let us say, specifically in order to capture the kind of processes we are talking about. However, they capture the outcome, there are conscious awareness of those processes, from which I do not think we can deduce that the processes which are being captured are exactly the ones that are actually going on. Because I do not think that our awareness of our mental processes, and again Christian was referring to it in the introduction, is necessarily deserting me. So the answer is yes and no, and probably no.
Right. Time for, I think, probably one more question.
Would your arguments still apply to quantum computers?
That's a very interesting question. I think insofar as they apply to any computers, they should apply to quantum computers as well. Yes, I can't see why not.
Even though you argue that quantum computers actually hold all the solutions?
No, they don't. Oh, no, they don't. No. They can do all the calculations on a given data, which is not the same as all the solutions.
Interesting. Okay, well, time for one more question back now.
About the link between anomalous mechanism and thought.
Yeah.
Anomalous mechanism may be a useful model for describing thought. It doesn't necessarily follow that anything which satisfies the laws of anomalous mechanism is necessarily a thought.
I couldn't agree more. That's why I stressed that I did not propose any correspondence between the two. I was merely investigating whether the argument of anomalous monism logically made sense. And it's an intuition pump. It is not an argument, what I presented. It is an intuition pump which simply says, well, maybe anomalous monism is not quite as unlikely as unlikely as we thought.
Thank you. I think that's it. Yeah, sorry. I think we'll have to stop now, sorry. But Mike will be only too happy to answer questions.
Absolutely.
Deep breath.
Thank you.